But it's a journey of his life story on the force. It's going to be a lot of voices, not just Jason's. Jason's is the story. I'm more of research-based, how to help Jason and others like him.
Talk about it in the book about my wife would tell me that, you know, all my friends were Leos. Sometimes we don't even know we need help. You can tell me to ask for it, and that's great, and I will. I'll let you know if I do. But I don't even know I do sometimes.
Read books like this, because there are so many books right now for police officers, because we need to focus in on keeping them in the job.
Why would you go out in life with nothing in your mental health gun belt and then expect when stuff happens for you to be prepared?
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB. I'm David Dashinger. And on this episode, we'll be speaking with authors Barbara Rubel, she's the director of Grief Work Center, and Jason Palomara. He's her co-author of the book Living Blue. Our topic will be police wellness and resilience. We invite you to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook,
Respond to Wellness Inc., and Responder TV.
Also on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website with all past episodes is respondertv.com. We'll be back to have a great conversation with Barbara and Jason right after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers. With vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB.
We'd like to welcome Jason Palomara, Barbara Rubel to Respond to Resilience. A little bit of their background. Jason is a U.S. Navy veteran and retired New York City Police Department cold case homicide detective. Jason has served as a peer support counselor with the NYPD, and he's been a recent guest with us on Respond to Resilience, talking about his role as director of veteran and first responder engagement for Forge VFR. Jason and Barbara have authored a book called Living Blue, Helping Law Enforcement Officers and Their Families Survive and Thrive from Recruitment to Retirement. Barbara is a leading authority and award-winning author on burnout, secondary traumatic stress, compassion fatigue, and vicarious trauma. As a nationally recognized keynote speaker and trainer, she motivates law enforcement officers and victim service providers to focus on wellness and resilience. She was featured in an Emmy Award-winning documentary and is the author of But I Didn't Say Goodbye, Helping Families After Suicide, and a 30-hour CE course for nurses on loss, grief, and bereavement. Barbara's website is barbararubel.com. And we'd like to welcome Jason and Barbara.
How are you? Thank you.
It's nice to see you back, Jason. And nice to meet you, Barbara.
Thank you.
So I was curious, Jason, how did you and Barbara meet? And why did you begin writing this book together?
Great question. I read But I Didn't Say Goodbye. That was during the time I was a peer support member with the NYPD. After reading it, I said, I have to reach out to her. I think it was via LinkedIn, Barbara. To my surprise, she responded pretty immediately. And over the course of that exchange, I always had this idea that I wanted to write something in support of mental health and wellness for first responders. You know, going through my time on the job, I wanted to give back. And I had this idea, and I said, well, you should just say no. But she didn't. And that's what brings us to today. I reached out and said, I think I'd like to write a book. Would you like to do it with me? And she accepted.
Well, Barbara, curious about this because it seems like you do have a deep interest in law enforcement officers, and certainly they're struggling with a number of different issues these days. So, what kind of brought you into that area? What attracted you to it?
My dad was a sergeant in New York City. He was a police officer, and my mother was also a police officer, one of the first law enforcement officers in New York City in the 60s. And they met and fell in love. And after his retirement, like too many police officers, he ended his life. He had deteriorating discs in his back, and his suicide note said that he couldn't live with the pain. And too many law enforcement officers live with pain, whether physical, as in my father's case, or mental, and they end their life. And so my goal in life, my life's work, my passion is to make sure, to ensure that law enforcement, fire, first responders, essential workers stay healthy so they can continue doing the job. Because if we lose these individuals, then who's going to take care of us when there is a fire or a crime or with any situation or critical incident? So I'm very passionate about making sure they stay healthy, their wellness, their resilience, and their well-being.
We thank you, Barbara. So just to stay along the lines of the book, we're very, very intrigued by this and, of course, want to read a copy right when it comes out to print. Have there been any challenges that you faced, Jason, or difficult parts of writing this book and trying to capture the words?
Challenges, the first thing that comes to mind is in recounting some of the situations I describe in the book, I didn't realize how it would really affect me, you know, kind of brought up some old feelings. There's one in particular. I was a rookie cop and rookie detective, more specifically, and we responded to a job of a dead infant. And I won't get into the details, but you know, we left that job, and it was very matter of fact off to the next one. Actually, off to breakfast, and then off to the next job. There was no debrief. There was no, hey, how did that make you feel? There was no, is there anything, you know, you want to talk about, you know, nothing. There was no talk of that job. It stayed with me, and I didn't realize how strongly it stayed with me for so many years until I started writing about it. And I realized how emotional I had gotten. At that time I had young children, which probably played a part in how I felt and why it stuck with me for so long. But yeah, that was a challenge in talking about and writing about some of the things that I was writing about, bringing up some of the old feelings.
This is sort of a common theme where, you know, many of us who are or have been responders have been to calls that we never really totally get the process, or we don't even know what the resources are to help us debrief and kind of diffuse whatever the feelings are. What do you find is working? And what do you find is missing in terms of how leadership is providing resources for the rank and file?
When I just got back from Fargo, where I did the keynote, I opened up the conference for the Midwest Summit for Women in Law Enforcement. And so it was a 2-hour kickoff conference on burnout and compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma and secondary traumatic stress. And then I did a training just for brass, just an hour on what do leaders need to know? How do we create wellness programs? What do we need to focus in on? But what I found in that 2-hour period is that most law enforcement officers think they're just burning out. They're stressed out. And they need to be educated and empowered that it's not just burnout. Of course, we understand what burnout is, but it's also secondary traumatic stress. The victim experienced primary traumatic stress. It's also being vicariously traumatized. It's also compassion fatigue, which is a mixture of, you know, burnout and secondary trauma. So when Jason just shared the story of the deceased baby in the vehicle, and then no debriefing, no critical incident stress management or any of that back then, he just went home and self-medicated or just, you know, went on to the next job, not realizing that he was traumatized. He's experiencing the same symptoms as perhaps the driver of the vehicle. You know, the obsessive thinking, being frozen, not being able to cope, distress, anger, all that stuff. And what happens to law enforcement officers is they become vicariously traumatized. And when you are vicariously traumatized, you are forever changed cognitively. So when Jason shares this story that happened 10, 15, 20 years ago, what he's sharing is, I was in such a place, the symptoms, these cognitive changes, my identity changed as a human being. I no longer felt safe. I no longer, I might question my own abilities. I may not want to connect to people because you can lose them, lack of control, your sense of self in the world. That's vicarious trauma. And it changes the way you think about the world. So we need leaders and supervisors to get on board to help these law enforcement officers, because that's not going to be the only critical incident that they have on the job.
Our greatest asset is a thinking, knowledgeable, well-trained, physically fit, and healthy firefighter. It is the continual drive to be better, to improve, and to never be satisfied with the status quo. Success begins long before the alarm comes in or the tones go off. Success is nothing new in the FDNY. We did not suddenly wake up one day and become good at what we do. We need enthusiastic leadership and training that has a clear understanding of what's at stake. That is teamwork. That is dedication. That is well-trained firefighters ready to go to work on game day. The time to train is now, before the incident or game day.
We've all seen the leader who's tactically proficient but lacks the people skills for true inspirational leadership. Cornerstones of Leadership, on and off the fire ground, discusses the soft skills necessary for success, both on and off the fire ground.
Jason, when you think about the things that you went through and how you had to compartmentalize and not process at that time, and maybe even in some cases after that time, what are you hoping the book will be able to do for other law enforcement officers after they've read it? What would you like to see happen after the book?
The quick short answer is for them to realize that they are not their problems, that they are not their stresses, that they are not their situation, that, and I've said this before, and it bears saying over and over again, that we're human beings that happen to be police officers and not the other way around. And when we start to identify as 100% that, we lose a lot. What this book is, it's a glimpse into my Leo experience and how it affected and touched on every aspect of my life. It'll be different from the readers, but it is just an example on how I navigated my time, and how maybe from my good examples and the things that I had done maybe wrong at the time will help you maybe make better steps. And if it helps but one person, it's a success. Late Dallas Willard, he was a professor and director of School of Philosophy at the University of SoCal. He said, "Lack of information results in everything from unpleasant burdens to stark tragedies across the entire range of human life." So I look back on the information I had or didn't have at that time, and that was a big piece of how I navigated my stressful experiences. And when the information is coming from another Leo, it sticks and it's more accepted because of the trust factor, right? We're in this tribe, we're in this community of people that nobody else can know what we know, right? So when the information comes from one of us, it's more impactful. So if I can be impactful for at least one, then I'm happy.
Well, it's also the understanding too, right? So not only are they in your tribe, they know what it's like to walk in your shoes, but if you try to talk about that with another friend who doesn't know what it's like to be in a cruiser, in an ambulance, behind a dispatcher's phone, they just cannot fathom the magnitude of what you see in a career and the fact that the frequency of it is so often. Right? You were talking about that call before. I mean, you go from one thing that for a civilian would be the most horrific thing they've seen in their entire life.
Yeah.
You go from that, get a cup of coffee, and then go to another, which would be the worst in someone's entire life. And that's just another day at the office for you. And I think I like the fact that you're highlighting that because it gets minimized. And I know all of our colleagues who see this in therapy, I see it in my office. What first responders do is consistently minimized by the first responders, but also by the others around them. And I like the fact that you're shining that light on the magnitude.
I think if I could just follow up real quick, I think we as Leos minimize it because maybe we're afraid to do the opposite, right? We want to keep those experiences in our blind spots. Because if we entertain them, you know, it could be uncomfortable. And I say we get uncomfortable to get comfortable. And I stayed uncomfortable for a long time until I said that I can't do it anymore. So I have to get uncomfortable, not knowing what the end result was going to be. But yeah, sometimes we do minimize it.
So Barbara, love to go a little deeper with what you were just saying about working with department leaders and how occupational exposure to vicarious trauma is affecting responders. What are some practical tools and things that you share in your trainings that you might be able to pass along to our listeners?
Well, I did a deep dive into the research before I did this presentation in Fargo a couple of weeks ago. And what the research points to with LEOs in particular is the have to focus on physical fitness, so important. And when I shared this particular slide all about physical fitness and all that, someone raised their hand and said in their department, they implemented a brand new thing where an hour a day, an LEO can go to the gym. They can come in an hour later, they can come leave an hour earlier or stay extra hour at lunch and have 2 hours. That is amazing. So physical fitness, also stress management, teach them how to manage their fight and flight and all that, you know, stress stuff. Focus on mental health, alcohol and substance abuse, nutrition and diet. These are the foundations. And then your department goes from there. But we need to make sure that supervisors talk openly about wellness and resiliency to basically give them permission to talk about it because a lot of them are type where they're not going to. But we need to open that up to peer-to-peer support, being a good listener, and knowing how to spot mental health needs and substance abuse and suicide ideation and train leaders to connect with their workers to the resources. I think, you know, Jason mentioned this before, how, you know, it's too much. You know, before we got on this podcast, he was sharing how when he needed support and he went online, there was just, where do you go? So it's so important to train the leaders, the sergeants, the detectives, the brass to connect their workers with the right resources based on the culture of their department. Also, off-site support, telehealth, support groups, counseling, therapy that works with law enforcement. And we must be mindful that the wellness program has to fit with the department culture. That's so important. And know the perception among peers. You know, they're labeled as broken because I asked them. So this was all just from the last presentation. I'm labeled as broken. I don't want to be a problem. I'm losing my identity if they take my gun away. You know, confidentiality, privacy is important. But we need to all be on the same page about wellness and resiliency on the force.
Yeah, I love what you're saying because we've touched on this before, but really giving the leaders the training and the resources and knowing when they one of their people that they're supervising comes to them with a problem or they notice a problem that they know what the proper resource is because it's mandatory. It should be as mandatory as doing some of the training that we do as police, fire, and EMS.
Yes.
I was wondering, Barbara, when you're in front of the brass, do you get a sense for the fact that they understand they are the living, breathing model and embodiment of what their department is expecting of the inferiors? Do you think that they look at themselves and realize that they really are the model? So if they're not taking care of themselves and they don't talk about things and they don't talk about their struggles at all, and it's this facade of strength, do you think they realize that?
They do realize it, but I think there's a lot of fear, anxiety, and worry. and they really need to be together in a group, sharing their own common situations at home where they feel safe and confidential exposure, like talking to another chief, because I had a lot of chiefs in the room. So chiefs talking to other chiefs about their own issues and just giving each other permission as human beings that we need to take care of ourselves and then show those who work with us how we are caring about our own wellness and well-being, how we're building our resiliency, how we're using our strengths, and model that behavior. And I asked some of them, would you share with anyone that you were seeing as a psychotherapist, a therapist, a social worker? And they said, no, but I would give them permission to go and give them information about it, but I wouldn't self-disclose. So I thought that was interesting.
Come on. Check it.
I wanted to touch on an article that you wrote. It was called Suicide in Law Enforcement. And you mentioned a book, sounded fascinating. It's called Trauma and Recovery by Judith Herman, MD. And you cited a passage in there that when there's no thought of the future, it keeps one relegated to their current state. And that in enduring one's pain, we create the misbelief that there's no end in sight. Can you talk a little bit about how Leos have feelings like loss of control and hopelessness, and how does that all play into the picture of suicidality?
Great question, and I appreciate you asking it, because we're supposed to have all the answers, right? Or at least that's our belief. We're supposed to respond to a scene. We write a summons. We make an arrest. We mark the job somehow, right? We move on to the next one. We've definitively solved that issue in whatever way we did. When we don't have the answers, in my opinion, to our own problems and our own stressors, we too often blame ourselves, right? Well, I'm supposed to have the answer. I'm the fixer. I'm the helper, right? People come to me for help, and I don't have that answer. It's real easy to then, you know, when we're blaming ourselves to call it a day, to say goodbye, right? Because to further that, when we feel that not only do we not have the answers, but because we don't, that we're the reason, we're the cause of the stress in our family's life, right? And they maybe be better off without us creating all that stress. You know, we talk about some of the instances in the book that I write about, and I would come home and it wasn't the baby, for example. It wasn't like, hey, hon, you know, guess what I did today, right? I didn't want to tell her about it. So what do? I isolate myself, self-medicate, you know, elbow therapy, whatever you want to call it. I stay in my own world. Right. And that just builds and builds and builds. So, you know, when you talk about enduring one's pain, that pain can be sometimes very unbearable. And that momentary, that irrational decision that's so permanent is not easily seen in that moment.
Thanks, Jason.
Barbara, do you see what Jason just said as a common theme in your work?
Absolutely, it is. Absolutely. And that's why we really need to focus on how Jason and other law enforcement officers can make meaning out of their job, out of the tragedy, the critical incidences, the death, the trauma, the crime, the children suffering. How do you make meaning in that? And that's when you make meaning, you are compassionate to yourself. You know, you're showing yourself self-compassion. So if I was working with Jason, I would say, Jason, share your job narrative with me. What does your job as a law enforcement officer mean? You know, I would want him to reflect on his beliefs, his values, his worldview, so he doesn't die by suicide. So he stays healthy and a husband and a father and a member of his community, you know? And so how do you do that? You know, just consider how your role as a law enforcement officer impacted your life, whether you are retired as Jason is, or you're just starting out, just got out of the academy. You know, it's your family bonds. Maybe your family means more to you now than ever, or you value your relationships with your buddies. You appreciate their support, or you experience personal growth. You have changed priorities because of what happened. It's truly about making meaning of your narrative and then being kind to yourself when you think I should have done something differently, or why didn't I do that? Or I could have said this. It's about being self-compassionate, being kind to yourself. It's all Kristen Neff's work on just recognizing that you're human and being self-kind. So understand that aspect of your personalities. Don't be critical. Don't be judgmental. You're a human being. Yes, you made a mistake, or you could have done something differently, but we're connected to other people, other law enforcement officers, other firefighters, other educators, or whomever in the community who also might have screwed up, you know, and just be mindful, you know, keep it in a balanced view and live your life like in the light rather than in the darkness. Just be compassionate, find meaning in your life, and know that you're doing the best that you can with a very, very difficult situation day after day after day.
Thank you, Barbara. That's profound. And, you know, it makes me think of something I heard early in my career, and that's, you know, as first responders, we really have one chance to get it right. And, you know, very few times we have the opportunity to rethink it, do it over. And so it makes us even more self-critical when we perceive that we've made a mistake or didn't do it right. So it just raises the bar that much more for us to lighten up and be in the light rather than the dark. Jason, you're really a master at sort of having the macro view of a career. You know, you kind of look at the whole arc of it from probie to retirement, and that there's actually an evolution of the self from the beginning of the career to the end. Can you talk a little bit about that, the concept of self and how that changes over time?
Absolutely. I just want to touch on something Barbara said about how do we do that, and it plays into, you know, that arc of your career is making it familiar. Right. Sharing life experiences, which is what this book is making, you know, we talk about break down that stigma, right? Sometimes we don't even know we need help. You can tell me to ask for it, and that's great. And I will, I'll let you know if I do, but I don't even know I do sometimes. We don't know that we need to ask for help. So when you start out as a civilian, you enter the police academy, right? You're going to go through that arc you talk about, and you're going to learn the good ways of doing things, the bad ways of doing things, productive, non-productive. And you're going to develop around that world, like we do in any job. But when I talk about it in the book about, my wife would tell me that, you know, all my friends were Leos, to what was true. Because I couldn't find those besides me, you know, some grammar school friends, my military friends. I couldn't find any that could relate to what I was going through. So I further creep into that bubble, right? And now you get to the end of that arc and you're retired and you leave. And I think we talked about this once, David. We look in the mirror. Who are you, right? That person's unfamiliar to us, right? It's different from what we've been used to for the past 20, 30 years. My partner, Steve, retired after 40 years. So imagine that. Imagine, you know, leaving after that amount of time and having to relearn who you are again. That's a scary place. And that's where we see a lot of Leos at that point die by suicide, right? It covers the entire arc, because if you start talking about it on day one, throughout, up until and through retirement, it's not unfamiliar. Unfamiliar, scary. So that's part of what this book is, and many like it, is making it familiar through a shared life experience.
My colleague Stacy and I run a weekly peer support group for all first responders, and this topic comes up a lot about the importance of having friendships and interests outside of being a law enforcement officer or police, fireman. These jobs become so much of your identity, and dare I say, the vast majority and percentage of your personality is that. So it's really, really important to find those other ways to still be human and connect with the world, not just in preps for retirement, because that is a huge consideration. Now this person's losing 80%, 90% of who they are, you know, when they leave an office or a department. But we try to get them to think about it, too, for just the longevity of their career and from the mental health aspect. It's not healthy for anyone to be in any profession 24 hours a day. It takes a toll. And that's what you're speaking of with the family and the kids and isolating from your spouse. Because even when you're not on duty, your brain is still on duty.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in cold case, I'd be lying if I told you I didn't think about those cases every second of every day that I was not at work. But, you know, at work is one thing. When I was home, it was, what am I doing next? I probably wouldn't change it because I felt that that's where the success came, was just being so engrossed in every piece of the case. But there was a toll. It was a toll that it took on me and a toll that it took on my family. And that's what, you know, officers need to understand, is that they can be great at their job. They can also be great off the job. They can be great husbands. They can be great wives. They can be great fathers. It is possible. And when all you know is that, you know, they say you're the sum of your, the five people you spend the most time with, right? If all you spend your time with is that world, you know, it takes a toll.
To jump to an interesting term that you've mentioned, it's compassion satisfaction. Recently, we talked about the numbing out and burning out that many LEOs experience, as well as other responders. Can you talk about compassion satisfaction and how that relates?
Yeah, well, we understand job satisfaction. We love our job as a law enforcement officer, a firefighter, whatever you're as an essential worker, whatever it is you do, you love your job. But when you are satisfied with the level of compassion that you give to a victim, a client, a patient, then that mitigates the impact of compassion fatigue. So compassion satisfaction, I'll give you a perfect example. I was working as a hospice bereavement coordinator many years ago. It was the week of September 11th, as a matter of fact, and the patient was actively dying. And I'm holding her hand, and her husband, who's about 90 years old, is holding the other hand, and he screams out, "She's dying. What do I say? What do I say?" And I say, "Tell her you love her. Hearing is the last to go. Hold her hand. She can feel your presence. She can hold your hand. Just talk to her." And he was talking to her and telling her how much he loved her, and then she took her last breath. Now, in that moment, my compassion fatigue could have been through the roof. But it wasn't, because my level of compassion satisfaction was so high. So it mitigates that impact. So as a law enforcement officer, we have to consider when we enter the home after domestic violence, or we are on the scene after a sexual assault or a major crime where people are killed, all hell is breaking loose. But if we are compassionate, if we are empathetic, if we are caring, if we are doing our job well with a situation that's really bad, then our compassion satisfaction increases and our level of compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma decrease.
Can we do that on a, you know, say much smaller scale? Let's say we go to a, you know, someone's having a difficulty breathing and they just need a ride to the hospital. Is there, you know, on less sort of traumatic call, is there a way we can have compassion satisfaction?
Absolutely. As human beings, we know that we are doing good, that we are in a helping role, that again, we're being empathetic, we are caring, we are compassionate, we are doing our job and providing some assistance and help in the aftermath of some type of trauma. Whether that trauma is a small trauma or a large trauma, it's still a trauma. You know, however we define that stressor in that person's life, we are there to help. So move into the satisfaction you feel as a helper. However, I do a lot of conferences for nurses, and many of them are sharing with me that they're experiencing moral injury. And what that means is that they want to do more. They know they have to do more, but they can't with what they have. So we're impacted by so many things. I think the bottom line is we just have to do the best we have with the situation at hand. But what you mentioned, that happy, that laughter and joy is so important. Laughter reduces anxiety. It reduces stress. We know that humor increases mental well-being. It lowers levels of loneliness, less headaches, cognitive flexibility. You know, the list is endless. We need to have a sense of humor. Now, during my programs, it's a 5-minute activity. I give everyone this toy. It looks like a straw. It has a helicopter on top and they go like this and they fly around the room. Everybody laughs and they have so much fun. It's a 5-minute activity. Why do I do that? Because I explain to them, look, we're talking about homicide, co-victims, suicide, trauma in the workplace. That's my thing. I'm a thanatologist. And yet for 5 minutes, we took the time out to have fun. If we could just make sure that we find moments of joy, moments of awe, moments of spirituality in our day, while we are continually bombarded by crisis and loss and trauma and crime, we're going to be okay. And I think we need to just start with being okay and then move up from there.
It's really like a microcosm of life. Feeling joy, feeling happiness, connection, satisfaction, and reconnecting to the purpose why we got into this profession in the first place. To me, that's one of the most disturbing things is that, you know, we get into it for really pure motives. I think most people want to become a cop or firefighter, or paramedic to be of service. And then somehow down the line, we lose touch with that pure purpose. But we can also reconnect with it. So thanks for all the work you do, Barbara, because it's so much needed.
Thank you. But you know what you're saying is that law enforcement officers move into their career because of their personality, because of their character traits. They are a unique human being. And so we need to focus on their strengths and look at what strengths did you have when you went into the academy? And now through your career, are you still using those strengths? Are you careful? Are you brave? Are you determined? Self-control, kindness, skillful? How do you put those strengths into practice? How did you put them into practice when you first became a cop? And how are you continually keeping those strengths in the forefront rather than focusing on your weaknesses? Use your strengths, put them into practice, and I think you'll be okay.
Superpowers.
Yes. Yes, because, you know, you do know law enforcement officers wear a cape. I do have those throughout my training. I have so many slides with capes on it, and the cops love them, so I just keep them in. But we, you know, we have to understand that we don't wear a cape. You know, we're more like the Hulk. The Hulk doesn't wear a cape, and he's pretty powerful, right? He just turns green. So I think know your strengths, and I think that's a good way to start.
Dave, you mentioned be of service. We forget to be of service to ourselves. You know, we're first responders, and that's what we need to be for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll be of no value to anybody else.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
I want to talk a little bit more about the book, especially the process, which I find fascinating, having written a book with my wife. I know it's not necessarily the easiest thing in the world to do. Sometimes it seems like, we'll just, you know, sit down and write a chapter a day or whatever. But there's a lot more to it than that. And it's probably a much deeper sort of journey, for a personal journey, to write that book. So can you, Barbara and Jason, speak a little bit about the process and what it was like?
It's fascinating. So this is my first experience in doing this. And I am beyond fortunate to have met and become friends with Barbara. Again, taking me under her wing and showing me the ropes. I didn't know there were multiple types of editors. So I'm still learning as I go along. But what's really fascinating about this whole process is that we've essentially done it virtually, right? I don't know how often that happens, but it's through, you know, being in different states, through the limitations of COVID, we have done this virtually. So the exchange back and forth has been amazing. You know, I sent to her my stuff, and she sends it back, and we volley it back and forth, and we've done this over the course of probably a year and a half now, about. So it's been a fun journey, and that's exactly the word I would use, because it's ever evolving. I'm learning every single day.
As Jason just shared with you, it is definitely a journey, but it's a journey of his life story on the force. So he has a chapter about when he first started, a chapter with a critical incident, a chapter where he may be feeling burnout, a chapter where he might be experiencing secondary trauma. And there's several stories or several narratives woven through the several chapters. I'm taking his story and then I'm using it as a case study. What can other law enforcement officers, what can the brass, what can sergeants and detectives and those on the beat, what can we learn by Jason's experience? And then I'm going to share my own insight based on my experience as a family member of cops and as someone who delves deep into the research. What does the research say? How can we have helped him in this situation? What does he need? What can we do for him? What things can we list? What define, discuss, you know, all objectives to help him in that case study, because I want the reader to see themselves in Jason's experience. But then it's not just a narrative. It is, okay, this is what he needed to do. And then I'm going to reach out to officers across the country to share their insight and then just insert their comments throughout my research-based response to Jason's narrative. So it's going to be a lot of voices, not just Jason's. Jason's is the story. I'm more of research-based, how to help Jason and others like him, and then gain the insight from others across the country who can share something that they find valuable that a law enforcement officer needs to hear.
Wow, powerful combination.
It sounds like such a great balance between looking at someone's life as a case study, but then what could be done, you know, along the way. I think that's such a great balance you've come up with, and clearly you work really well together.
No, I was going to say, you know, as cops, we wear a gun belt, right? If we're on patrol. Detectives, you know, not so much, but this book is part of their mental health gun belt, right? And I liken it to that, because you wouldn't, and I talk about it in the book as a silly example, but you wouldn't go out on patrol with no gun. You wouldn't go out on patrol with no nightstick, baton, mace, handcuffs, right? All the other essential tools you need. It's part of your gun belt. Why would you go out in life with nothing in your mental health gun belt and then expect, when stuff happens, for you to be prepared? So that's what this book is. This book is just another tool. It's another tool for you to be better.
But Jason, you're preparing the new recruit through your narratives, because I've read every chapter. Your story, your the incidents, the crime, the loss, the trauma. A new recruit's going to read this and say, wow, is that what's going to happen to me? It might. Maybe. But at least now you're going to know how to respond in the aftermath.
It's not unfamiliar to them. It'll be familiar to them. And if it doesn't happen, fantastic. But if it does, it'll be familiar. It won't be so scary. Or maybe a little bit less.
So you want them to be armed and ready for what might unfold in their career and have it not be a surprise. You want them to see that you can go through it and these are some other options I could have used, and for this to really be a tool.
Have the information and not need it, then need it and not have it. And if they don't need it, well, the fact that they're better prepared will help that destigmatizing asking for help, because they're going to be the conduit for others to feel comfortable in reaching out. They're going to say, oh, okay. Right. And they're going to respond to that example. So they may not need it, but they might.
Well, you know what? Stephen Covey said the key is not to prioritize what's on your schedule, but to schedule your priorities. And what we are saying, what Jason and I are saying, is schedule your own wellness, your own well-being, your own resilience. Read books like this, because there are so many books right now for police officers. You know, the shelves are filling up with wellness and resiliency, because we need to focus in on keeping them in the job and respecting who they are and what they do, and making sure that they stay healthy and they go home to their wives and their children and their family members. So important.
And when they retire, that they're not a shell of themselves.
Right. Or in my father's case, you know, using a weapon to end his life. We do not want that. When you retire, you need to retire with the honor and respect and belief that, you know, you are resilient. And if you managed 20 years on the job, then you could still manage retirement and who you are in that retirement, family, friends, you know, just, you know, gain a spiritual awareness of your community, give back to the community, volunteer, do whatever you need to do to stay alive, because you are not alone. It's so important. You are not alone.
We really applaud you both for what you're doing, what an amazing service it is to law enforcement and the other responder professions. So thank you so much for writing this book.
So Jason, tell them the title, because it's your wife. Please mention your wife, her name, and why we're doing the title. I'm not mentioning that title. Jason?
So the title is Living Blue.
And why is it Living Blue?
It's Living Blue because my wife, Veronica, came up with it.
Right.
Now I will be able to have a happy wife, happy
That's
life.
That's why I didn't say anything. Thank you very much. I wanted to get that in.
It's really all about important. Balance.
It's all about balance. It's all about, you know, knowing that our family has our back. It's a wonderful thing, or it has our six. It is important to know that when this book comes out, it is going to help so many people. I'm online now on LinkedIn. I think I have 200 chiefs that I'm LinkedIn with. I'm going to make sure every chief gets it. I'm going to make sure that it gets in the hands of those who will then read it and then give it to somebody else. That's the best thing you could do with any book. Like, I wrote the book, but I didn't say goodbye, Helping Families After a Suicide. If you have that book on your shelf, get it off your shelf, give it to your library, give it to some, hand it to a teacher, a nurse, a social worker. That's the most important thing that we could do when we have books, is take the book and then give it to somebody else, because you might be saving a life. You never know. Books are so important. We need to share our knowledge.
And that's exactly what happened here, right? I want to call out the obvious. I read a book by Barbara. It affected me. I had an idea. We're now connected, writing another, which will help other people. So the power of somebody's words in just one book has the potential to multiply if you allow it. And that's what's happening right now because of one book.
And not only one book, one podcast. You and I, Jason, are on this podcast today sharing our book, and it's all great. But we don't know who's listening, who might have ended their life like my dad, who's saying, you know what, maybe I could rethink this. Maybe I should speak to somebody. We don't know the impact of what we're doing. All we know is that we're supposed to be doing this. And there's powers and spirituality beyond us. And in the long run, I just hope that people listen, they stay healthy, they find joy in life, they have a positive attitude, they keep their boundaries, they stay connected to others, they laugh a lot as much as possible. And, you know, we just need to be self-kind as well. You know, we just incorporate our strengths and we're all going to be okay.
And keep that curiosity for tomorrow. That's it. Keep that curiosity.
That. Yeah, it's great.
Looking forward to reading it. Thank you both for your time. Jason, thank you for another hour spent with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're going to be called a regular from now on.
Well, I appreciate it.
A true pleasure. Both of you are doing great, amazing, and important work. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Barbara. It's been a real pleasure having this conversation.
Thank you both.
Thank you for what you do.
Like to remind everyone to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook,
Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV.
BBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and check out our website for all the past episodes. It's ResponderTV.com. Until the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.